Our first presentation for this afternoon is on Leading Vital Congregations, Proposals for Clergy Effectiveness. Bishop Alfred Gwynn, Jr., from the Raleigh, North Carolina Episcopal area, and also a member of the Study of Ministry Commission, will be our moderator this afternoon, and I'm going to let Bishop Gwynn introduce the rest of the panel.
Thank you, Linda, and grace and peace to each of you this afternoon, and good afternoon. It's a delight for our commission to be able to share this report with you. And in a very brief introductory way, I want to remind you that this Ministry Study Commission report is a follow-up to the 2008 Ministry Study Report, and it is under the direction of the 2008 General Conference, which said to us that we should address the issues before the church regarding the ordering of ministry, the separation of ordination and conference membership, and the streaming of the process of leading toward streamlining of the process that leads toward ordained ministry. So we have been talking and working together in that way. We have been listening broadly to the church. We've consulted, if you please, every area of the church that we know to consult. We have talked closely and in detail with the Commission on Faith and Order. They have looked over our material and gave us advice and help in regard to that. What we will be presenting to the General Conference is a full consensus of 28 persons from around the world that represented every segment of ordained ministry and the laity, and persons from Europe, Africa, the Philippines, and the U.S. came to a total consensus on this report, which we believed was a consensus from listening to the church at large. This report is an attempt to help the church as it talks about moving from an institutional focus to a missional focus. And we have on the panel today four members of that 28-member commission. And next to me is Jay Williams. Jay is a probationary member, and he's from Boston, Massachusetts. And next to Jay is Tom Choi. Tom is a district superintendent and an elder in Hawaii. And next to Tom is Amy Gerhardt, who is an ordained elder in the Missouri Annual Conference. And next to Amy is Ken Carter, a district superintendent in the North Carolina Conference and an elder. We wish that a deacon could be with us. Western North Carolina Conference. What did I say, Ken?
I said North Carolina.
Oh, I wanted to claim him, I suppose, being from North Carolina. I'm sorry. He's from Western North Carolina. And we wanted to have the deacon particularly. There were several deacons on our commission, but the deacon who helped Ken write the report, Margaret Crane, is not able to be with us today. But we wish Margaret could be with us. And so Jay is going to come first now and help you begin to understand a bit more of our report, which you can find in full detail on the General Board of Higher Education website. If you go to their website, you can see our ministry study report in its totalness, and there you can study the details. What we're doing today is giving you only a glimpse of some of the major parts of our report. So, Jay, you come now and lead us in the first phase.
If you might, could you put the presentation up on for viewing? There we go. This is the day that the Lord has made. Amen. Just to reiterate the charge that was given to us by the 2008 General Conference, the charge was that we would look at the ordering of ministry, we would streamline the candidacy process, and we would separate proposed legislation for separation of ordination from conference membership. For the next couple of moments, I'm going to talk to you about how we are proposing the streamlining of the process as well as the separation of ordination from conference membership. Our team has been working diligently, and we've been listening to, as Bishop Gwynn says, listening to the voices of folks from throughout the connection about the current state of our ministry. And now, as one as who is a provisional elder who began a process in one annual conference that no longer exists, that is now a member of another annual conference, but yet serving in a third annual conference, as I enter into my ordained ministry, I can tell you from personal experience that our process is cumbersome and perhaps overly lengthy. And so the charge of the General Conference from 2008 to streamline it is one that I can speak with about with passion. As we look towards the next 200 years of the Methodist movement, I believe in order to equip our denomination, our movement for ministry in a changing age, we really have got to do something around the entering into that process. So in a way, this report comes to you as the continuation of work that's already been done, but it also does represent a fundamental shift of some ideas and thinking that I'm hoping that as we talked about the Pentecost and Spirit being the possibility of it breaking forward in General Conference, I hope that we are open and willing to hear what God is prodding us to do as we move forward. So what our commission is presenting is in this shift is could be grouped in kind of two ways. The first, we're looking at the culture of call. We're also looking at a conference vocational discernment coordinator. And then thirdly, an orientation to ministry. If you could, yes, that was the charge. If you could advance to the next one. Yes, we know the challenging times. Oh, fantastic. Technology, yeah. So, right. So there's many challenges that we're all aware of in terms of, and you can see some of the statistics on there, that basically, as the numbers look, we will not have enough ordained folks to carry out the mission if we continue at the pace of recruitment and retirement that we're currently on. Therefore, we're prodded to make some changes. The first, then, we're suggesting is that each annual conference will adopt a culture of call where vocational ordained ministry is considered and presented and strategically lifted up as a viable option, a viable vocation in the 21st century. And one such way of doing this, we're suggesting that each board of ordained ministry have a vocational discernment coordinator, which would be an individual who candidates for ministry could go to for advice when they're really beginning to enter into the process. And right now, there's many. You might go to a local pastor, you might go to a district superintendent. The process can be somewhat cumbersome. We want every annual conference to have a point person that candidates for ministry can go to, and then begin them in a process of discernment. So the process of discernment is also one where we found there could be some difficulty for candidates getting paired with a mentor that is a good fit. Sometimes the mentor isn't always aware of the process. So part of the responsibility of the vocational discernment coordinator is to facilitate group mentoring. So by bringing candidates who are beginning their journey together in a group setting to continue that process would be a way of empowering, strengthening during a time that can be very wilderness-driven, if you will. And then after the renewing the culture of call, vocational discernment coordinator, then we're suggesting that all licensed, at the beginning, all licensed and ordained ministers would, so those who are pursuing the elders track, those who are pursuing the deacons track, and those who are called to lead as local pastor would take part in a shared orientation to ministry, whereby all the folks could begin to understand what the other roles are, the other orders, and it's also building a sense of collegiality among those who are entering into ministry at the same time. So the culture of call, vocational discernment coordinating with a focus on group mentoring, and then an orientation to ministry. And then the second major proposal from on this area, the process into ministry, is that the separation of ordination and conference membership. In effect, we are suggesting, and the vision you can see is that after a candidate has served as a certified candidate for at least 1 year, they will be eligible to be immediately ordained. And then they would be ordained basically after they've completed the 1 year and all of their educational and preparation requirements. So in essence, what this means is when a person is sent out into full-time ministry, they will be equipped with the full rights as an ordained person. They're sent out to function as an ordained person in the community to represent the church, as presiding at the table, ordering the life of the church, etc. Then they would be equipped with the appropriate credentials as an ordained person. The reason why we're suggesting this is manyfold. In fact, the 2004 to 2008 General Conference proposed this as well, the elimination of commissioning. So we're continuing on their wisdom and fulfilling this because, in essence, we've tried commissioning since 1996, so now for about four quadrennium, and we've essentially gathered that it just does not work. We don't have an articulated theology of commissioning. Our practices of commissioning vary from conference to conference, so the persons who are commissioned into ministry, full-time ministry, and beginning their probationary period are really in a liminal space where it's not clear how we exactly want them to serve. Are they provisional elders or deacons? Are they members of the order? They're sent out to function as such, but then are not equipped with that. And then finally, because this process is rather difficult to explain to our ecumenical partners, no one knows what we're doing, to be honest. I mean, in other circumstances, you would not be sent out to serve in a parish with sacramental authority unless there's exigent missional circumstances. This wouldn't be a regular part of the ordering of ministry, and this is what we're hearing from our ecumenical partners. So we're proposing then to eliminate commission, eliminate the liminal status that confuses the process, and that is rooted in a theology that has not been fully articulated. Amen.
Aloha.
Aloha!
It's good to be here. Coming from Hawaii, it's nice to be in cold weather. Now, let me tell you something. The word aloha is really of two words. Alo, which means shared, and ha, which is breath or spirit. And therefore, the word aloha means shared spirit. And so, even though we may have differing opinions, as including like what is cold weather and what is not, I hope that we do share the same spirit, the Holy Spirit, through God and through Jesus Christ. So if you'll turn to those of you who brought your 1956 books of discipline, if you'll turn to page 149, for the rest of you, let me read paragraph 431.9. Every traveling preacher, unless retired, supernumerary, which it was that word for being on incapacity that we use now, on sabbatical leave or under arrest of character, must receive an appointment. Now, the reason for this was, if you'll remember, this was the year that women were first ordained into the Methodist Church. And so this legislation was put into the 56th Book of Discipline to protect women clergy, because there were at least one bishop and probably more who were going to refuse to appoint women to churches. Therefore, what this was a protection for all preachers, including the first women. And then in 1968, when our United Methodist Church was born through the merger of the EUB and the Methodist Church, the central jurisdiction was abolished, and then for the first time, African-American ministers could be appointed to any of the churches, and also included were the ethnic provisional conferences. So we had this idea of open itinerancy. Now, let me just say that our particular section is called, this particular section is called missional appointment making, and let me say that back then, this security of appointment was to allow security and missional appointment making, to allow women and ethnic people of color to be given a missional opportunity to be in any church in our connection. Now, the issues of sexism and racism have not gone away, but we are not in the same place as we were 42 and 56 years ago. And so, in some ways, this security of appointment has devolved into you need to secure the job for all pastors, whether or not we have positions. Bishop Gwynn was sharing with us during the ministry study that there are about 800 more elders than there are full-time positions for in our connection. Is that still true, Bishop Gwynn? 700 and I think 87 is what you actually said. But anyway, so that's where we are. Now, we propose to change the language about security of appointment, and Amy is going to talk about that in a bit. But there is a question about whether or not elimination of security of appointment will lead to congregationalism in appointments and will be like some of these other denominations. I just want to point out, now in your 2008 books of discipline, if you have that, if you'll turn to Section 3 of our Constitution, and I'm going to read paragraph 19, which is Article 3, and it says this: "The General Conference shall not change or alter any part or rule of our government so as to do away with episcopacy or destroy the plan of our itinerant general superintendency." So no matter what happens, the episcopal system and the itinerant system will remain. Now, related to that is a question that there are people who believe that there is a covenant involved, that there's a breaking of covenant by removing the security of appointment, which is that elders agree to itinerate and the bishop and cabinet promise an appointment. But before 1956, and probably back to 1784, we had itinerancy without security of appointment. And so I believe that in this time, we need to focus not on security of appointment, but on securing the future of the mission and ministry of Jesus Christ among the people called United Methodist. Thank you.
It has been truly a delight and a joy to serve with colleagues like these gentlemen up here on this ministry commission. And probably the most exciting part of our life together was, in addition to eating and being able to enjoy one another's company together, one of the greatest things about our coming together and the work we did together was that we rooted everything that we did in our mission. And we started the conversation with, if our mission is to make disciples for Jesus Christ for the transformation of the world, what is the way that we best do that? And one of the things, one of the earliest discoveries of our work together was that frequently our mission was serving the structure instead of the structure serving the mission. And that's particularly important and real in the world of ordained ministry and the ministry of those whom we deploy for ministry in local churches and extension settings. So we had to, first of all, put the first thing first, which was to set before us the mission of the church. And then we had to look at those systems that were freeing us for that mission and those systems that were standing as obstacles to that mission. It was very clear to us, as Tom has already iterated, that itinerancy, open itinerancy, is fundamental to fulfilling our mission as United Methodists. And we hold very strongly as a commission that open itinerancy is not only a value, but a practice that is essential to seeing our mission further into the 21st century and beyond. However, one of the greatest obstacles to fulfilling our mission in this place where structure, the mission was serving structure instead of structure serving the mission, was what we call in the discipline security of appointment, or what we call on the streets guaranteed appointment. We realized that in order for us to be missionally faithful as a church in deploying human resources, if you will, deploying resources of leadership into our local churches and extension ministries, it's essential that we have leadership and we have resources that are creative, innovative, nimble, flexible, and most significantly even contextual. And it was important to us that we looked at how we can fulfill that mission through the deployment of our leadership. So discovering that barrier to mission, being guaranteed appointment, we had a very hard conversation over this past quadrennium to talk about the implications of what that would mean. What came to us in our collaboration in our hearing, my friends, were generous and beautiful stories of how bivocational ministers are turning communities around, of how new church start pastors that have other careers during the daytime but are there preaching and practicing ministry are turning lives around. We've heard beautiful stories of innovative ministry that happens when we're able not to always have to place someone who is tired or ineffective who needs to find new ways to live out their baptismal call as a blessing of the church, so we might make the room for someone else who has high energy and high understanding of contextual settings. We also know the reality of migrating clergy, and this is a new reality. Clergy are not any longer home to just one annual conference. They're moving around with spouses who get jobs and other opportunities, and we need to be nimble and creative. And as long as we are locked in to the commands and demands of the guaranteed appointment, that makes it impossible for us to put the mission before the structure instead of the structure before the mission. So the Ministry Commission requires and suggests and recommends a couple items that have to go along with this kind of moving the barrier out of the way. The first being transitional leave. We are going to need to be able to place elders and deacons in full connection on transitional leave. This should come normally and typically out of a collaboration of understanding the ministry needs and the ministry supply and the gifts that are needed to make good and missional ministry happen. Another issue that was raised was the concern about the authority of our Episcopal leaders, our bishops. And so one of the understandings and recommendations that we put into the report is that every year the Jurisdictional Episcopacy Committee needs to meet, that's different from the previous every 2 year requirement, every year, and that one of the primary agenda items of that meeting is to check and monitor for the bishop's commitment to open itinerancy. You see, what we did was in recommending the removal of the security of appointment as a barrier, we are continuing to lift up and identify the significance and primacy of open itinerancy. Finally, one of the things that we have heard throughout this wonderful commission experience is a story of the church doing wonderful, beautiful, faithful work. And our job, while we understand that this will help to work with some issues of ineffectiveness, we also understand that this is not a magic wand. This is not a silver bullet for ineffectiveness. What this is making the very best room for the mission that is already being taking place all over our world by United Methodists to be further advanced so that the kingdom of God can be realized in places that are crying out for new leadership. And I hope that you'll join us in that work together.
Good afternoon. It's a privilege to speak very briefly about sacramental authority and the ordering of ministry within this ministry study. I do feel compelled to say a word about the actual study itself. It's common, especially amongst longtime church leaders, veterans of these types of gatherings, to make fun of studies. But we discerned fairly early on that the alternative to not studying set-apart ministry would be simply to gather together for these 6, 7, 8 days of general conference in a compressed, politicized atmosphere, and to try to make the best decision we could. And we likened this to building a house without an architect or without consultation and deliberation. And so we think it is good for the church to study what all of this means. One of the guiding principles for us has been that the fullness of set-apart ministry is deacon, elder, and local pastor. And that we are about a differentiation of these three classifications of set-apart ministry and clarity about them, not fusion about them, but that we want to arrive at some kind of understanding of them across this global church where we see deacon, elder, local pastor not in competition with each other, and not in some kind of hierarchical relationship. They are different, and the church needs each of these classifications. Deacon, elder, and local pastor have a common ministry, and that is to word and service. But they also have distinctive ministries. The elder is called also to sacrament and order. The deacon is called also to compassion and justice, and the local pastor to witness and mission. And our church needs each of these distinctive ministries. We also reflected on how each of these set-apart leaders connects the church in some way in terms of our connectional system and polity. The elder is the primary person who connects the church to the denomination. The deacon is the primary person who connects the church to the world. And the local pastor is a primary person who connects the church to an individual. The elder through order, the deacon through service, the local pastor through proclamation. We also discerned along the way, and this was a guiding theme of our reflection, that we were seeking to order the ministry for the sake of the mission. Gil Rendell, in his book, Journey in the Wilderness, talks about an institution's public and private mission. Perhaps you've read this. For example, in a school system, a school system's public mission might be to educate children. But its private mission might be to hear the concerns and the voices of its most powerful constituents, parents, teachers, administrators. And so we did take very seriously our powerful constituencies across this global church, but we also tried to see clearly before us that the reason we have set apart leadership is for the sake of the mission in the world. And we believe that our work, together with work that flows from many other places, the Church Systems Task Force, the Call to Action, and many other places, are all about strengthening and enhancing the mission of Jesus Christ, which is to make disciples for the transformation of the world. This is our public mission. We really recommend no changes in relation to sacramental authority. And this is not just about maintaining the status quo. It is our belief that the order of deacon is so new that it needs to continue to be developed and really claimed by the church as we seek to connect the church in the world. We do believe that the order of elder is where sacramental authority resides, and that the local pastor has sacramental authority given by the bishop through that order. And so this is what we bring to you as we seek to continue to think about set-apart leadership for a larger purpose, accomplishing the mission.
So, friends, this is a very, very light, general covering of our report that I've said earlier you need to read in detail, and you can find it on the GBHEM site. And so we're going to open up our panel now for a time of question and answers. I just remind you that we are trying to follow out the mandates of the 2008 General Conference. And so in seeking to do that, we have sought church historians, we have sought theologians, we've sought the mind of the larger church in regard to the proposals that we do bring before the General Conference. And our commission was very prayerful. In fact, we had a covenant that we signed together in our initial couple of meetings. We had this covenant that we worked out in agreement with one another. And so we read that covenant as a prayer on almost every session. And we would read it 2 and 3 times a day because we wanted to be in covenant. And our members did not seek to protect an order or a fellowship. Our members sought the will of God as best we could understand it, and particularly the health of the church. Now, so we present this report to you. It's a gift in some ways to the General Conference. We understand, even though it's taken 3.5 years to get to this point, you have a right to do anything you want to with it. But we'd love for you to know a little bit more by asking the panel some questions. And I'll sort of guide you. There are microphones in each of the aisleways. And let me recognize this gentleman over here with the book. If you'll come to the microphone, ask a question, and we'll direct it to one of the panelists. Or if you want to direct to that panelist, you're welcome to do that.
Thank you, Bishop. I'm Wee Chang. I'm from New England. And I thank you for the work of the commission. I have 2 questions. I wonder whether the commission has considered the mission and merits of guaranteed appointments that are still existing. I can only speak from my experience. I've been serving cross-cultural, cross-racial appointments in 4 settings. And guaranteed appointment gave me the freedom to speak truth. It gave me the room to be prophetic, not concerned much about what my people in the pew want to hear, but help me to be truthful and authentic to the Word of God. I think that's missional. And there should be other missional merits still existing, the guaranteed appointment. I just want to know whether the Commission have given the full thought about that, and that merit was still fell short. Mm-hmm. Related question is, obviously, if this change is adopted, it will enhance the power of the bishop in the cabinet. We are already a centralized institution. And I'm wondering what other mechanisms, processes that commission is suggesting to, as an antidote to, obviously, the growing power of the bishop in the cabinet. Because the guaranteed appointment also gives all the clergies freedom to speak truth to the cabinet and bishop too. And I think that serves church well too.
Yeah, thank you. Very important question. And Tom, would you like to take the first part of the question?
Okay. Sure, thank you for that. Thank you for that question. I agree that we need to preserve the prophetic pulpit. Now, I think what was behind the question was an assumption that the congregations now have more influence over their choice in appointment. But remember, as I read before, we still have an itinerant system. And so the bishops and the cabinets are going to be protective, I think, of prophetic pulpits. And we'll continue to do so, and I think that will be retained. and that they will be allowed to speak prophetically, and they'll be protected because the bishops and the cabinets will still continue to appoint. And so congregations don't necessarily have more influence over the appointment making process.
There was a good bit of dialogue, in fact, probably hours of dialogue regarding the issue of prophetic ministry and the importance of protecting that. And I think in a moment, maybe Amy will unfold how we believe some of that protection can take place in addition to what Thomas said.
Right. As I mentioned, we already have put into the report legislation recommendation that the work of the Jurisdictional Episcopacy Committee is going to be strengthened in the expectations that we have of it to really monitor our Episcopal leaders around open itinerancy. And we know that there's all kinds of other checks and balances that go on in the life of our church to help make sure that we are monitoring and holding ones accountable for the practices of open itinerancy. Another awareness came out also as we've discovered more about folks moving and being transient around our connection. And that is, people go where there are good bishops. And people know where our great bishops are. And word gets out, especially among our young clergy, that if we have folks that are not practicing open itinerancy, that may not be the annual conference I'm called to serve in. And so we're dabbling with a totally different cultural reality now with conference membership, with how our clergy practice going around the connection and offering themselves to the church in new ways. I visited with 102-year-old Bishop Frank, Eugene Frank, frequently. He was in my parish, and I did his funeral last year. And he said to me, "Amy, I can't imagine being a part of the church today." In the 1950s, our attitude on the cabinet was one-size-fits-all church, one-size-fits-all clergy. Now, we know that that wasn't the reality all the time, but that was the kind of culture that he was operating out of as a bishop predominantly. We are not in those days. And so bishops will be held accountable not only through the formality of our structures, which we need to have in place, but in the reality of the economy of people coming and going to be in ministry in those conferences.
Okay, thank you, Amy. And may I add just one thought here? Please keep in mind that the bishops and cabinet continue their partnership with the Board of Ordained Ministry. So even as bishop and cabinets now are able to recommend leave of absence, there is no more power for a bishop and a cabinet to not use or appoint a person unless the Board of Ordained Ministry enters into agreement through the transitional leave. So there is that check and balance, and I think it's an important one. And I'm going to recognize someone at the mic, but I'd like to be recognize your hand, then you go to the mic, okay? So let me recognize you if I might.
Actually, you answered my question. Jan Davis, North Texas, that was my question about the power of the Board of Ministry.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, if the Board of Ordained Ministry doesn't agree to transitional leave, then the bishop and the cabinet do have the assignment to assign that person. All right? Okay, right here. Let's go here, and then we'll come here. All right, and then we'll get you. And I don't want to forget over here, so be sure and raise your hands pretty high. Yes, microphone here in the middle. I don't have a number.
That's right. I'm Laura Easto from Baltimore, Washington, and I want to know, I serve on the Jurisdictional Episcopacy Committee, and we do not currently have the power to do what you're saying we can do. So I want to raise the reality of our life together, which is to say our Jurisdictional Episcopacy Committee meets every year, and we conference with our active and invite our retired bishops every year. But there is not a power in that committee currently by the discipline that allows there to be a holding accountable in the way that you're describing. And that's very troublesome to me because that's a huge part of what you're talking about. So I'm wondering what else you looked at. Because I think fundamentally what you're really trying to get to, if I'm assuming correctly by reading all those pages, is at ineffectiveness, right? Which is the issue we've been trying to get at for a long time as a denomination. How do we help ineffective clergy to retool, to do something, to live out their baptismal call, is the phrase you used. So I'm asking, what else did you look at that would allow us to not, you know, the statistics are still staggering. Less than 1% of our large membership churches in the United Methodist Church are pastored by women. So, yeah, it's been since 1956, but, you know, women are bishops and women are district superintendents. We do middle management pretty good, but large membership churches, they're, right now, if bishops had to stand and talk about appointing women to that, that's not happening across the board. So that's the reality of who we are together. And I'm wondering how we can deal with effectiveness taking away the guaranteed appointment.
Sure. And who would like to?
I'll address the first part of your question about the Jurisdictional Committee on Episcopacy. Paragraph 524 outlines the responsibilities, as I'm sure you know. And in it, if you'll notice, the committee has jurisdiction over paragraphs 415 and 416, but not 414, which is the making and fixing of appointments. That's part of the duties of the bishop. The legislation proposes that we add 414 under the supervision of the jurisdictional committee. So for the first time, the jurisdictional committee can oversee, monitor, and supervise and review the work of the fixing and making of appointments of a bishop. And so that's a major difference and a major way in which we have a check and balance on open itinerancy.
Ken?
I want to thank you for the question and a very real concern, and maybe respond to the second part. It is not only or maybe primarily about ineffectiveness.
Right.
It's really about missional appointment making.
Yeah.
The district, and we're talking anecdotally about our experiences. The district that I serve is all in Appalachia. And currently, our discipline requires that the pool of clergy be considered first to be elders. But there are congregations in my district that would flourish with a local pastor. But if they are required to be matched with two or three or four other small congregations to place an elder who let's say maybe is ineffective, the persons who are most damaged are the persons in those local churches. The persons who sometimes suffer from our current polity are the most marginalized churches who must receive persons from the pool of clergy. This is to open up the process of appointment making, and we do need to consider every concern that's been expressed in terms of prophetic pulpit. I totally agree.
All right. Now, let's go to this microphone. We'll recognize you, and then I want to look this way. Yes, sir, I'll get you in just a moment.
Yes, Kim Reisman from the Indiana Conference. As you thought through the whole the guaranteed appointment process and recognizing that we're all elders are the same, regardless of whether they're appointed to a local church or elected as a bishop, I'm just curious how the removal of the guaranteed appointment process would affect the fellow elders that are currently serving in the capacity of bishop. And maybe this will be handled in the later section, I don't know, but was there any thought to term episcopacy? What kinds of conversations went on related to how bishops fit in as fellow elders in our order, how they fit into the appointment process?
Okay, all right. Yeah, you'll go ahead, Amy.
We did have some spirited and significant conversations about that very question. Thank you for that. And what we decided was that we needed to crack the door open and walk through it And this issue in particular around the episcopal authority, as well as many other issues related to, for instance, exiting clergy, issues of severance, issues of what relationship do people have other than active status in transition? How does that look? We've decided as a commission, I think pretty early on, that much of this is going to have to be worked out in this adaptive culture. That we haven't come here with something on a silver platter saying we've got it all polished and worked out. And that's one area that after there is a quadrennium of jurisdictional episcopacy committees and bishops and cabinets and boards of ordained ministry working together, we're going to have a lot of consequential issues that we're going to have to work out, and that was one of them for sure. But we are also experiencing those Episcopal leaders right now who are already helping us to experiment into that, who are inviting a very different kind of evaluation of their ministry than ever before. My bishop's one of them. We also have Episcopal leaders who are experiencing an understanding of maybe they're going to reenter into a local church in the retired relationship. So we have all kinds of new experiments that are happening, not only for the elders that will be directly impacted by this, but also for those Episcopal leaders who are also elders. And we're going to be growing into that as we go. And this is highly adaptive, and it's a culture that we're going to step into together.
All right, fine. This microphone?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Under the section on sacramental authority in your report, you read the discipline in such a way that a license for ministry granted to licensed local pastors and to provisional members does not necessarily include sacramental authority, need not necessarily include sacramental authority. Have you ever made an appointment as such bishop? Have any other bishops done that? Is there some thought towards guidance in moving us toward the deployment of sacraments which with more integrity, which is kind of what this is pointing to, in my understanding.
Speak just a little bit more for clarity. I'm wanting to respond and have the panel respond, but I need just a little more explanation, if you can.
So you've said that in order to... You assert in the report that that a license for ministry granted to a licensed local pastor could be made... for instance, to do everything that a pastor does except celebrate the Eucharist, and that no disciplinary changes are that might be advisable under some circumstances because missional concerns are what drives that decision. Mm-hmm. Have we ever done that? It asserts that you have the authority to do that in your conference, Bishop. And so, have you done that? Mm-hmm. Has another bishop done that? Is there any guidance in the works, mm-hmm. thoughts towards looking toward?
Ken, I'll get you in a second, and then I'll answer him directly. Yeah.
And I'm not sure I completely understand your question, but let me offer a couple of sentences that maybe will get us toward it. Certainly, sometimes there are local pastors who serve on staffs of churches, and their primary role would be exhortation and preaching and teaching, but really they would not have sacramental authority in that local church. That would be the elder. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
But in our mission in the world, we need local pastors to serve many of our churches and charges, and the people in those churches and charges need the sacraments. And so the sacramental authority is given to those persons for that missional reason. In our history, it really is an extraordinary provision, but it has become more normative over time.
Yes, and in part to your question, if I'm also understanding, at the present, bishops are able to do what I think I hear you asking with deacons, so that deacons can be given the privilege of the sacraments under extenuating circumstances. Are we approaching it some?
Probably for the time being.
Okay. All right. Fine. I'm coming over here. Yes. If you'll come to the central microphone, and then we'll get somebody here. Somebody was right in here. Okay.
Tracy Merrick from Western Pennsylvania and a member of the board of the General Commission on Christian Unity and Interreligious Concerns. As the body probably knows, we are in full communion relationship with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and at the upcoming General Conference, we're going to be recommending full communion relationships with our Pan-Methodist friends. My question is, and this is of interest to us on GCCUIC, is are there components of the recommendations that you are putting forth which would improve our ability to see appointments between denominations with which we're in full communion relationship, or are there some changes that would be impediments? We probably want to do some work on that and understand it more completely as we're going to General Conference as part of our work. Could you provide some rationale?
Yes, very fine question. And who? Somebody want to pick that one up? Yes.
I know that Jay addressed the issue of commissioning, but I'm interested in other components
yes.
of it.
You want to go? And then I'll speak a word. Yes, go ahead.
Only that this was not primarily what the General Conference asked us to focus on. First, we were in dialogue with the Committee on Faith and Order, which has its origin also in the Commission. And our primary focus was more on the mission and not so much on our ecumenical partnerships. We certainly were made aware of that when it seemed that we were distancing ourselves from those relationships.
And I might say, anecdotally also, that in conversation with our Lutheran friends and our Episcopalian friends, they have been confused in our present arrangements. It's very confusing to them. And what we have done is to realign somewhat where we are in the ordering of ministry as United Methodists, which does make it cleaner and clearer to our ecumenical friends, and therefore I would think would allow a little cleaner kind of sharing of clergy.
Okay. Yes. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. All right. I promised right here, and then I'll get you. Yes, ma'am. Right here.
Jen Ilo, Baltimore, Washington Conference. Reverend Isto just asked a question a few minutes ago about the role of the jurisdictional episcopacy committees in reviewing appointment processes to ensure that they are fair across the board. And the answer, as I understood it, was that paragraph 414 of the discipline would be moved under the jurisdictional episcopacy committees, giving them the ability to review those appointments. There's a difference in my mind between reviewing what someone does and being able to hold accountable for should a review reveal a problem. So has that been addressed?
It's review and evaluate the work of the bishops, pass on their character and official administration, and report such evaluations and other findings to the jurisdictional conference for such action as the conference may deem appropriate within its constitution, warrant of power, and it includes then adding 414 with 415 and 416.
So Episcopal Committee could recommend that the bishop not be appointed?
At all.
So the issue that the, if I could take just a second, the issue that the commission faced as we went along for 3.5 years is what kind of step can the General Conference and the General Church handle? We can't move completely because it's too big of a change for us. But as Amy said a moment ago, can we open the door a bit? Can we take a step or two before we try to run in the issue? Now, I promise you, yes. And I don't know. I know the clock keepers are watching. Okay.
Scott Campbell from the New England Conference, Bishop. A question probably directed to Jay about the nature of the relationship of a person to the annual conference once that person has been ordained but is not yet a member of the annual conference. How is that relationship understood? Secondly, what happens to that person should they not be received into the annual conference, but then have the credentials of one being ordained.
Thanks, Scott. So what we're proposing is that at ordination, one receives provisional membership and then would continue into the minimum of a 2-year probationary period, at which time they'd be eligible for full membership. So we do think that the time of residency and growth in ministry is still important, even though ordination we're recommending to happen earlier. If by either the choice of the boom, then the clergy session, or the ordained person does not come into full membership, then both the credentials for ordination and conference membership should be surrendered.
All right. Very similar to what we were doing in 1992. We ordained twice, and we ordained deacons, and if they did not move on for whatever reason to an elder, we had them surrender their credentials. So it's very similar to what we've already practiced.